Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And I'm going to look today at the war reporting on the Eastern Front during Operation Barbarossa. This kind of neatly dovetails two themes together that I've been following over time. Firstly, the Barbarossa podcasts I've been doing recently, and secondly, the issue of war reporting in the 20th century. One of the great paradoxes about war reporting on the Eastern Front is that despite the fact that it was the biggest land battle, or the biggest theatre of operations of the Second World War, or indeed of any war, with the numbers of troops on either side eclipsing any other theatre of war during World War II, the actual amount of war reportage, accurate and well-established war reportage on the Eastern Front, is fairly thin on the ground. There were some significant well-known Western journalists in Russia, and obviously Soviet journalists with the Red Army. But of course, the German army, the Wehrmacht, had its own embedded reporters and produced its own version of the truth as well. And this had the effect of ensuring that Western readers confused about events in Russia. They relied on official accounts from the Soviet Union, which were generally reported in British and American newspapers in the most generalised of terms. Now, it's hardly surprising when Britain and America are fighting their own battles in their own theatres of operations in the Pacific, in North Africa, for example, for them to focus almost exclusively on their own achievements and setbacks. But the question of Russia and the Russian front would be decisive in the outcome of the war. And because it was so very poorly understood, this fact alone is largely lost on Western readerships. In the aftermath of the Second World War in Great Britain, as far as the British are concerned by and large, the war involved the Battle of Britain, Dunkirk, the Blitz, North Africa and D-Day, and some perhaps less well understood things happening in Burma as well. The conception of what the war was based in the information that people during the war actually received, and also the interpretations they made of it thereafter. So Russia's kind of relative absence from the attention of Western journalists goes on to shape sort of popular perceptions of the war in Britain and America thereafter, and obviously historiographies going on into the long into the post-war era. And it would eventually be things like the 1970s production of The World at War that would bring home in its entirety the Russian front to an entirely new generation of viewers in Great Britain and around the world. Now, as I've said previously, Barbarossa was common knowledge across Europe before it began. The movements of troops and the loose tongues of everybody from diplomats down to journalists and, you know, the general public across the various Axis states meant that very few people were taken by surprise, except, of course, the various daily newspapers of Britain, America and Canada. On June the 22nd, there were only 7 Western journalists in Russia. Erskine Coldwell and his wife, Margaret Bourke White, who were doing a feature for Life magazine about the Soviet countryside, of all things. Correspondents from the Times and the New York Times were nowhere to be found. And instead, the normal news services of Reuters, United Press, Associated Press, and one journalist, A.T. Chollerton of the Daily Telegraph, were present in Russia, but with little idea about what was about to happen. So one does wonder slightly about their news-gathering skills. So it was Nazi Germany that broke the story. The Western press took their information from official pronouncements by the Third Reich itself. One week earlier, German correspondents had been briefed about the impending operation, and all telephone communications from Berlin had been severed to prevent there being any deliberate or unwitting transference of key top secret information. At a press conference on the German Foreign Office at 6 a.m. on Sunday, the 22nd of June, Joachim von Ribbentrop made the official announcement. Their correspondents were then allowed to send their stories back to their various countries immediately. There was a broadcast on Radio Berlin, which was picked up in London and in New York, and the headlines appeared within the day on London and New York evening newspapers. But of course it was the German reporters that had the exclusives. A German reporter, Karl-Heinz Seiss, was flown over the battlefield by the Luftwaffe for the Frankfurter Zeitung, and the story landed on Monday, June the 23rd, which had the first accounts of the fighting. Seiss wrote, "The attack against the enemy begins. There is a target just below, a marvellous sight to see. There are many large hangars at the edge of the airstrip, lined up as if on parade. There is a mass of Soviet Russian fighter planes. The bombs from our plane fall accurately and with excellent results. Right on the nose. The enemy craft on the ground burst into flames and the fires spring from one to the other." And this would have been a fairly accurate state of affairs. The majority of the Soviet Air Force was destroyed in the first couple of days on the ground as Stalin deliberated about what to do. The belief that Stalin had was that the attack was either a hoax or an accident, or there was some other explanation for it, and he was determined not to retaliate, less to provoke Hitler and give the Allies the Nazi-Soviet war that they wanted. So the refusal to scramble aircraft not only came from that, but from the fact that most of Stalin's most senior air marshals had been executed in the latter stages of the Stalinist purges. The entire infrastructure of command and control of air defence had broken down because so many experienced officers had been executed or imprisoned. In the first couple of days, 2,000 aircraft, nearly the entirety of the Russian Air Force at that point, was destroyed, along with 7,000 tanks, and 500,000 men were captured, with 1 million others taken prisoner. Nazi newspapers reported that the reason for the ease of the invasion was that Soviet citizens had believed a pernicious and now clearly untrue Soviet myth, the belief that any power, capitalist, fascist and what have you, attacking the Soviet Union would collapse within hours because the workers of that state would not tolerate a war being waged against the Russian proletariat and would rise up and go on strike and the entire society would crumble. Therefore, the Nazi newspapers suggested this meant that the rather slow-witted Slavs over the border hadn't invested in proper defences, and they had been really relying on this strategy that did not account for the fact that the German people would unite as one. Now, of course, information being communicated on the Soviet side, the breakdown of information goes far beyond bad reporting or lack of journalistic know-how. It was really the kind of the breakdown in communications of government itself. The Soviet high command found it difficult, and the Politburo found it difficult to actually find out the scale of the disaster because of the chaos that Stalin had wrought throughout the army and civil defences in the previous few years, and the source of the chaos really was Stalinism itself, that weak defences or bad news or setbacks were simply not reported, that people on the ground were too afraid to admit to there being the crisis that there was. The first communique that was published at 10 p.m. on June the 22nd gave a strong impression that the Soviet leaders had no understanding of the scope of the disaster. It said, "In the course of the day, regular German troops fought our frontier troops but achieved minor success in a number of sectors." And it took until July the 3rd for Stalin to emerge from his existential crisis at his dacha outside Moscow and to broadcast to the nation, "Comrades, citizens, brothers and sisters, fighters of our army and navy, my words are addressed to you, dear friends. The perfidious military attack by Hitler on Germany and our fatherland began on June the 22nd. It's continuing. In spite of the heroic resistance of the Red Army, and although the enemy's finest divisions and finest air force units have already been smashed and have met their doom on the field of battle, the enemy continues to push forward, hurling fresh force to the front. Hitler's troops have succeeded in capturing Lithuania, a considerable part of Latvia, the western part of Belorussia, and part of western Ukraine. The fascist aircraft are extending the range of their operations, bombing Murmansk, Orsha, Mogilev, Smolensk, Kiev, Odessa, Sebastopol. Grave dangers overhang our country. How could it have happened that our glorious Red Army surrendered a number of our cities and districts to the fascist armies? Is it really true that the German fascist troops are invincible, as the braggart fascist propagandists are ceaselessly blaring forth? Of course not. History shows us that there are no invincible armies and never have been. Napoleon's army was considered invincible, but it was beaten successively by the armies of Russia, England and Germany. Kaiser Wilhelm's German army in the period of the First Imperialist War was also considered invincible, but was beaten several times by Russian and Anglo-French troops and was finally smashed by Anglo-French forces. The same must be said of Hitler's German fascist army of today. This army has not yet met with serious resistance on the continent of Europe. Only on our territory has it met with serious resistance. And if as a result of this resistance the finest divisions of Hitler's German fascist army have been defeated by our Red Army, this means that it too can be smashed and will be smashed, as will the armies of Napoleon and Wilhelm. So this was the first official communique to the Russian people. Obviously there are wildly misleading moments in there indicating that the Red Army is doing far better. But the interesting thing about it is the tone of the language that Stalin uses. Brothers and sisters. He's speaking to the Russian people in a way that he's never done before, talking to them in distinctly non-partisan terms and appealing for a sense of national unity. Stalin knew full well how weak his position was and how he had all but handed the keys to Russia to Germany and was desperate to try to salvage his position somehow. And from here on in, a very careful managing of news and propaganda was an integral part of the Russian war effort to prevent Russian people from embracing any kind of possible defeatism or come to believe that the war was hopeless. Private radios were confiscated by the militia. Loudspeakers were placed all over Moscow, making sure that broadcasts were heard by everybody, and particularly the Stalin broadcast. And news that came back from the front was the only front, the word of mouth that inevitably propagates during wartime, was the only alternate source of information. Official communiques would be broadcast but never really go into details, specifics and data. And the fact is that this was not dissimilar to the other Allied powers, who were very, very careful with the information that they handed out for very similar reasons. Heavy repetition of key phrases and the general lack of sophistry in the writing of official wartime propaganda, bear in mind when in Britain there was everybody from George Orwell to Dylan Thomas to J.B. Priestley working as wartime propagandists. So there was some kind of literary flair there at the Ministry of Information. The repetition of key phrases gave Soviet citizens important clues as to what was really going on. When it was announced that there was fighting in the Smolensk district direction, or in the Minsk direction, the key word in the communique was always direction. And it normally meant, people deciphered, that the where was being discussed had already been lost. Direction was a way of explaining that the Red Army was retreating. Some of the worst news was masked by the term heavy defensive battles being fought against superior enemy forces, which again very quickly became code to a military collapse or full retreat. Complex situations were again another euphemism, and the statement that nothing of consequence had occurred, which could both mean that nothing had actually happened or that there had been a military disaster that the army was not willing to disclose. Throughout the war, a series of Soviet journalists became household names and national figures as a result of their retreat and then later offensive with the Red Armies. Ilya Ehrenberg wrote for the Red Star and was a bitterly angry anti-German polemicist and later a vituperous figure of the Cold War attacking the West. his work was often syndicated in Western newspapers. Vasily Grossman was perhaps the most famous. He wrote the famous book Life and Fate, and his war correspondence has been immortalised. I think Anthony Beaver wrote a book about him. Konstantin Simonov, another key figure. If you want to read about Simonov in depth, get Orlando Feige's The Whisperers, and the story of Simonov is and his rise to being a celebrated poet and literary figure, and almost a kind of like the Hemingway of Russia, a rather larger than life character who lived extremely lavish lifestyle as one of Stalin's favourite journalists. Orlando Feige's writes kind of very, very great depth about him in The Whisperers, so well worth a read. Those are the three key war correspondents. Ehrenberg in 1942 wrote, "We did not create our life easily, but this rough and polished life was our own way of life. It reminded one of the rough draft of an astounding poem, all blotted and scratched. When we were building nurseries, evil news came to us from the West. They were building bombers which would kill hundreds of children in one night. The smell of Germany's animal breath was wafted to us, and we said to our wives, 'You'll have to wear the old wedding dress another winter.'" And this version of Soviet history that Ehrenberg was putting across, this published on the anniversary of the October Revolution, and it was a way really of him presenting the Soviet Union as being whiter than white, as being entirely innocent, and the victim of capitalist and fascist aggression. And as I've said before, part of the way in which Hitler was able to surprise Stalin was that Stalin had bought into a conventional Marxist-Leninist interpretation of what fascism was. It was essentially capitalism's attack dog. Well, that may well possibly have elements of truth to it, but as far as Hitler was concerned, Hitler wasn't in the thrall of capitalist powers. Instead, he viewed the Soviet Union from the prism of racial thinking. Throughout the 1930s, there had been a lively scene at the Metropole Hotel in Moscow, where the Soviet hierarchy and Western journalists rubbed shoulders looking for exclusives. And by 1941, that scene was very much diminished. However, some of the fellow travellers, who were the left intellectuals and journalists who, whilst not being communists, had deep sympathies with the Soviet Union, came running back to Russia as quickly as possible, knowing the territory and reporting on it effectively. Now, there is probably not the time in this podcast to give Western journalists and their involvement in the Soviet Union the depth it deserves. So we're going to continue this one at some point in the near future. But I think to sum up, really, there were very specific reasons why the largest battlefront in the war was so underreported, and why it was so fundamentally inaccessible for Western journalists, those journalists having obviously fled Russia as the purges intensified, and returned home aware of the kind of the very dark atmosphere in the country by the late 1930s. And obviously by the time the war broke out, Stalinist paranoia at its height made it an almost impossible environment for Western correspondents to work. So there are very specific reasons why it was such an underreported war initially, but as time goes by, gradually corresponds particularly people like Alexander Wirth, who wrote on the freeing of Leningrad, were able to apply their trade more effectively. Okay, thanks everyone for listening. And again, apologies, there have been a few technical blips recently, but I think we've ironed all those out now. I'll be giving away a book hopefully sometime over the weekend, so do tune in and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Thanks very much. All the best. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.